Hey everybody, this is Greg with another Greg Talks 15. This week we have an interesting guest. It is Tony Owens.
Hello.
Ah, the dulcet tones of Tony Owens. So we give everybody a heads up. Again, this is a podcast companion to the Brothers Wisp, right? And it's a lot of my thoughts during the weeks. It's also a very informal mix of technical and non-technical. And today, I had the distinct feeling that it's going to be very non-technical, but I think it could be interesting, could be instructive, could be informative. What do you think, Tony?
Maybe. Definitely, I agree with the non-technical portion of it.
All right. So, Tony, let's start at the start. Where are you from, man?
Originally, I was born in Midland, Texas, but grew up about 20, 30 miles north of Houston in Humble. So moved around a little bit when I was a kid. My dad went to school a little later in life, so lived in Waco, which I know you're from, right?
Yeah.
In Waco when I was probably 4 through 6, maybe, while my dad was getting his undergrad from Baylor. And then moved to College Station, which is where you're at now, while my dad was getting his graduate degree from A&M. So, and then ended up in Houston, where he started working for Exxon back in 1986. So, stayed in Humble really from like third grade through high school, and then went back to College Station to go to school, and then attended and graduated from A&M.
So when you say Humble, people don't know where that is. What's that adjacent to?
It's like Kingwood, Humble. It's up 59 north on from Houston.
Okay.
And 1960 and 59 is kind of where that is.
There you go.
And it's Humble. The H is silent. People get upset about that.
You have to be very specific because I know we have listeners kind of all over the place. So there's like a guy, Ollie, who lives in Norway, who listens to this. So.
Oh, well, it's a suburb of Houston.
There you go. So people truly, you have to be very specific when you're talking about that stuff. So what did your dad, what was your dad doing prior to going to school?
He did all kinds of stuff. He was a respiratory therapist for a while. That was when I was born in Midland. He was actually working at a hospital in Midland. Realized that he probably went about as far as he was going to go in respiratory therapy and decided to go back to school. And so when he went back to school in MIS, where at the time at A&M, it was called BANA, I think, Business Analysis, which is what everybody knows now as MIS. So he got his master's degree. I think he got his undergrad in just general business and then got his master's in MIS.
Gotcha. So that's an interesting transition from respiratory therapist to working for, you said Exxon?
He was a professional photographer for a while. He had all kinds of weird stuff that he did. So.
Many, many talents. Snake oil salesman, as it were.
Yeah, no, not sales. I could tell you that guy was never destined for sales.
He doesn't have the classical characteristics for it, huh?
No, he's very reserved. He was in leadership probably the bulk of his career inside of IT. I mean, I think one was given that he was older than the normal workforce that comes into beginning, right? So probably ascended the ladder much quicker than some of the newer hires, but very reserved, very quiet. Not a guy that would work a room for sure.
Hmm. So do you think, you know, that's something I've struggled with in the past, and I think a lot of other people. You know, it's funny. So I do that LinkedIn learning stuff. So I have a lot of educational stuff. Well, now LinkedIn's made it like super easy for those people taking your courses to like connect with you. So I'm like connecting with all these kids, like straight out of high school, just out of college, all these people looking for jobs and stuff. And it seems like, you know, once you get into the workforce, if you're young, if you're, you know, that kid, that ascension in the ladder seems to be kind of slow going, kind of hard to make that happen really quick. Do you think that really is tied to, I just perceive older people as being more responsible, or do you think your dad actually imbued those qualities? Like he was.
Well, I think there's definitely an element of maturity that comes inside of any sort of leadership position, right? And so if you come straight out of school, I used to laugh at I used to go back to A&M to recruit when I first started with my first company that I worked for out of school. And I would talk to these kids, and I say kids, they were like 2 years younger than me, right? So, and they would say, I'd ask them what their major is, and they said management, business management. I go, oh, what are you going to do with it? I'm going to manage people. Like that was the idea. and that was their sort of perception on what you do with that degree. So I think there's a level of maturity and understanding working in the business world for a little while. You know, when I started, I was in sales and I was an individual contributor, and I did that for probably 5 to 6 years before I decided to potentially go into management. So I think it helps to have that background, but it also helps to have that maturity, not only business maturity, but just really professional maturity, right?
Oh yeah, man. You know, I used to have a lot of beef with the idea that, you know, I had trouble getting jobs because I didn't have the experience, right? And then, you know, how do you get the experience without the job? So eventually you just take some kind of any BS job that will take you, that's a foot in the door, and you sort of work your way up. But I'd always had kind of a burr under my saddle, or whatever the saying is associated with that, until I got older. And then I realized, yeah, there actually is some merit to that. But you know what I mean? It's like, you still have to. So that's made me want to take in kind of younger folks, foster them, build them up, and then, you know, push them out of the nest. And I've had the opportunity to do that a few times, and it's been very satisfying for me. But it's, yeah, you know, it's like, I think a lot of times, you know, we always do that, right? A lot of your traits that you have are in spite of something that happened to you when you were a kid or whatever, right? It's like, I'm not going to do that. I'm never going to let that sort of thing happen. But let's reel back. So when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
A marine biologist.
Marine biologist? So what did you want to work with? That, like SeaWorld with the dolphins and stuff?
Yeah, I did, actually. Yeah. And my grandparents lived on the coast of Texas in a little town called Rockport, which is just north of Corpus Christi. Yeah. And used to go down there and spend a week to 2 weeks every summer when I was from the age of, you know, 9 through 16. And so used to go fishing a lot, and there was aquariums, and so kind of fell in love with that sort of stuff. And then my freshman year at A&M, I took a zoology class and figured out very quickly that I didn't want to be a marine biologist.
What was the turnoff? What made you realize it wasn't for you?
Well, you know, maybe I kind of lost that dream before I even went to school, but I always remember that that's what I wanted to do. And I thought it would be a cool job to go, you laughed, but to go train the dolphins and things like that at SeaWorld. Good thing, because I think they've like outlawed all those things now, right? At SeaWorld, my job would have been eliminated. So.
Yeah, it's a very problematic position to have at the moment.
Yeah, I think you look at it and you go, well, I want to be around the ocean, and it would be cool to be around the marine life, but you don't think about marine biologists being a scientist, I guess, at the time. Or I guess my feeble mind didn't figure that out. So, yeah, there was much more to it than, you know, it's sort of like my 10-year-old. She tells me she wants to be a baby doctor. And then I tell her how long she has to be in school. And she goes, oh, maybe I don't want to do that. You know, when I tell her she has to be in school for 15 years.
Gotcha. So the reason I ask that is, you know, it's most people think, you know, I want to be a fireman, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a marine biologist. They don't say, hey, I want to grow up to have a lifetime in sales and relationship management and stuff. So it's, you know, to me, like the evolution of how you get, you know, there's so many preconceived notions with salespeople. And I was as guilty as anybody else to just think that if you were a salesperson, that you were the quintessential slimy car salesman, right? And I think a lot of people carry that image throughout their life. But now that I'm on that side of the fence for sure. Well, you know what? Before I was even on that side of the fence, whenever I was just helping you guys out, you know, my perception of that changing, you, believe it or not, actually had a whole lot to do with my change in perception of salespeople in general, and how they can be, one, entirely transparent and honest and very consultative, like actually try and help you meet a goal. And I can say... I know, I mean, I'm looking a little bit more into it, but I still remember the first time you kind of took me back. I was surprised. So I've always been very calculating. I've always been very careful with what I say and when I say it in front of folks in meetings. Like, I don't know, like when I met you, I was working at Fibertown at the data center. You came in and I called you Silver Bullet, right? Because you were gonna save the day. I'm looking at your face right now. But I still remember it was probably a weekend. We were in a meeting and you were there. Brandon, who was our boss at the time, was there. And you basically told him that's to his face in front of everybody. That's a really stupid idea. That's a terrible idea. We shouldn't do that. And I had just never seen anybody be so boldly honest. I was like, I like this guy instantly. And so I think that kind of set the course for our interactions from then on. You were just always the most transparent guy. And so it just, I don't know, that was such a mind shift for me. Do you, like, where did that come from? Like that I'm here to help you, you know, as like a, I'm not just here to sell you some crap. It's like, where did that?
Yeah. You know, I don't like being sold to that way. You know, I have serious anxiety if I go into a car lot to buy a car, because I know there's going to be pressure, and I don't like feeling like that. And so for me, I don't want clients or anyone that I'm talking to feel like that. I mean, you're never going to convince somebody to do something they don't want to do. And so you can't go in with the mindset of, you know, this prospect or this person is thinking this way, this one way, and I'm going to convince them to think a totally different way. Now, what I can do is lay out the options and show them potentially a better way or just an alternative way. But I can't drag them into it kicking and screaming, because that's never going to create a very good relationship long term. And it's not going to be a real viable sales solution, you know, however you want to look at it. So for me, I've always treated, you know, sort of the golden rule, right? You treat people the way you want them to be, to treat you. Same as any sort of business interaction as well. I appreciate when somebody is very candid with me, you know, even in an internal meeting, if they told me, hey, that's not a great idea, and here's why. As long as there's a here's why, as long as there's not a, that's a really bad idea, and then we just gloss over it, and then I'm wondering why what happened there. So for me, it's always about just treating people the way you'd want to be treated. And I don't like being pressured at all into things, like at all, right? It makes me very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember I used to get, like, so when I was doing circuit negotiations with people, they would say, oh, well, you know, we can get you this discount, but you got to sign in the next week and a half or 2 weeks, and say, okay, well, give me the price after that, because that's absolutely not even going to happen.
But you know, what's crazy is some people will thrive on that. My wife would love to hear that. Oh, well, then what do you got? Because she's going to make that decision within about a 2 second time frame. So some people, they thrive on that. You've got to kind of read the room a little bit. But I tend to think that more people probably feel the way I do than my wife does.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, not everybody's got the power to make that decision immediately, right? So a lot of the folks we talk to, I mean, there is layers and layers of process and procedure they got to go through before they can make a decision, right? So the guy talking to you is not the guy that's making the decision. So trying to run that stuff. Oh, and man, when we would deal with folks in the public sector, it's like, forget about it.
Yeah, there's no point. They've got to have a committee and firstborn and everything else to make a decision.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, if you sacrifice enough goats within a year, maybe they'll sign some paperwork. Yeah, yeah. It's just, it's crazy how that stuff works. So that's always fascinated me. So you, straight out of college, you started working for Ricoh. Is that right?
It was a company called Icon. So my whole plan was not to go into sales. So I went to school sort of following my father's footsteps. I graduated in 2000. And if you remember, in 2000, it was Y2K. And IT people were really in demand at that point. Right?
Yeah, big time.
But in demand to be able to pull legacy programming language apart to add the one digit or whatever. I still don't really understand it, and probably never will, and I'm okay with that. But I went to school, got my MIS degree, which at the time they were teaching COBOL, so I learned how to program in COBOL. There's a viable skill, right? So did that, and when I went out for job offers, all of the entry-level IT job offers were like programming. And I'm like, I can't do that. I cannot sit at a desk for 8 hours out of the day and type, you know, and look for where the comma is missing. And I was one of the rare guys, and I think in our major, that, you know, a lot of these guys were, that was their life. They loved to do that. They would sit in a dark room and shove pizza boxes underneath their door at 3 a.m., right? And sit there and code all day. And they liked it, which is fine if you like that kind of stuff. I just didn't really get into it. I went into it to get a job. And then when I figured out that I didn't want the job that I went into, I had to pivot very quickly and realize that if you have a technical background and can talk and have some sort of awareness and enjoy having conversations, sales might be a good way to go from a technical perspective. So anyways, so I was I started to work at a company called Icon, which sold printers and copiers. It was a big distributor. So we weren't a manufacturer. We had multiple manufacturers that we could go out and sell. And I, an entry-level sales job there paid $18,000 a year as a salary and then commission on top of that. Now, some of these guys were making six figures, $150,000, probably $200,000. I got sort of a promotion right away. I was able to convince somebody of something that I was good at. So when I started in a specialist role. So I was in charge of selling our high-end color printing equipment. So I was calling on marketing managers and marketing companies and people that, you know, today we know of color printing of, you know, I've got one here at my house. If you work in an office, you might have 15 of them in your office, you know, copy of color copiers. That just wasn't how that was in 2001. It was a very expensive piece of equipment. I think our average sale was around $55,000 for one of these things. And some really advanced software to be able to, you know, match Pantone colors and create custom logo colors and things like that. So, I had a really good time with that. I was supporting teams and I was the product specialist, so I would be brought in and be able to give my dog and pony show.
You were the smart guy in the room, right?
Sure. Sure. We can say that. I did that position for four or five years probably, and then transitioned. They sort of combined two positions, so I'm still doing that, but they also gave me these huge printing presses to go sell, these $500,000 digital presses, which were not the easiest things to sell in the world because the people that bought them were your average, like, Kinko's and printer, and those guys are historically cheap and have no credit, so that was always a challenge. And then at one point, I remember saying that I was looking around and we had had some turnover inside of the management staff. There was usually about 10 to 12 teams there. And they were hiring these people that I was like, this guy's, he's not doing it right. Like, there were two of them that I remember distinctively saying, this is ridiculous. And so I went in for the job. I was like, I think I can do it 10 times better than this. This is what I want to do. And so went into management and had our new hire team. So my whole job was recruit and hire fresh off the boat salespeople, get them up to speed. So there was a lot of development and training, get them up to speed and promote them off my team within 6 to 9 months. So it was like this revolving door of people all the time. Did that for about a year and then sort of moved up. And when I left the company, so I was with that company for 14 years. And when I left, I was the director of sales and I had 10 managers underneath me, and underneath them was 85-ish reps, all for East Texas and Louisiana. So Houston, go east up to Tyler, and then over to Shreveport and all that good stuff. So that's what that was the first 14 or 15 years of my career.
Gotcha. So I got a lot of questions based on what you just said.
Okay.
It's always the people aspect of IT, of all this stuff that fascinates me the most, probably because I have the least understanding of it. And one of it is, you said, hey, there's a manager position. I could do this so much better. What did they supply you with training-wise? Like that's something I've found is that I've had a lot of bad managers and maybe like one or two at this point good ones. It doesn't seem like most companies do a good job of facilitating any kind of training for management or like how do you lead people or, you know, any of that stuff. It's like, what prepared you for that?
Yeah. So my experience is probably the polar opposite of yours. I was very fortunate in having some really strong managers, not only that I reported directly to, but around me.
Okay.
And in my career, I've probably only had, I can name two really bad bosses and I won't name them obviously, but, two people that I probably would not work for again. I know I wouldn't work for again. But the training aspect, they did. They sent us off to training. I went to management training, I guess. And, you know, it's sort of how to have tough conversations with people because you're just not used to doing that, right? Yeah. I mean, when you have to give critical feedback to an individual or, God forbid, you've got to put them on some sort of performance plan to either – get them up to speed where you need them to be or start working them out of the business. Those aren't things that you're used to doing and accustomed to doing if you've never been in management. So there was a lot of that. There was also my boss at the time. She was really good. And we used to have weekly meetings. And, I mean, she would walk me through just about everything. That was an open-door policy. If I had something, if I had an issue. But, you know, you also, when you have good leaders up until that point, you get to sort of, my big thing was, and I had it written on my board, was steal the wheel. There's no reason to go reinvent stuff. I'm going to steal something from somebody because if it's working, there's no reason to go try to create something. So I would take little bits and pieces of things that I thought worked whenever I was a rep from a leadership style. So, you know, it's funny, I had a job interview last week, and they asked me, you know, who do you model your leadership style out of? Have you read a book? Is there somebody famous? And I said, you're not going to like my answer because it's neither one of those things. It's really just life experience and being able to grab from people that, and you also learn from the people that weren't any good, right? So so conversely, you're learning and you're taking and you're not taking sometimes right. from some of those folks. So they it was a really good training program. But there's nothing like on the job training and sort of, you know, if you want to learn how to swim, jump in the deep end, figure it out real quick. So
I guess either you learn to swim or the problem solves itself really fast, huh?
There you go. You got it.
That's crazy. So you weren't like when you were a rep, you weren't like thinking, hey, I'm going to write this down because this is a really keen management technique. It's just, it seemed like it was something that worked well over time for, and I guess with you, and you just kind of stuck in your brain sort of thing.
Yeah. And you know, what's funny is when I first got into this management position, I'm a big sports fan, and I thought about, there's a old video of Vince Lombardi, who was the famous Green Bay Packers head coach back in the 60s when they won the very first, I think it was the first two Super Bowls. And it was, you know, he was, we're going to hit them and we're going to run and we're going to, and I thought that's how it's going to be, right? Like we're going to, and just, you learn very quickly that that's probably maybe not the best approach all the time, but you know, I had a lot of misconceptions about it and I learned a lot. There's a reason that, you know, you probably don't take somebody that's never been in management and throw them in there right away before they have any, you know, to go back to our very first conversation, right? You've got to mature and you've got to figure out what works and what doesn't work before you start applying all of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's fascinating to me though, is I've found, now that I'm working with a sales group, like everybody surrounding me is sales, you know, and the customers I'm talking to are obviously technical folks for the most part. I mean, there's some C-levels in there that are a little bit more on the business unit side. Right. But, the management has been night and day so much better than I've ever seen with it. But, you know, that could be a product of Red Hat as well. I'm not going to say it's not because I'm surrounded by some extremely talented people there. But it just seems like the management structure is there with really good people, really amazing training. It seems like they focus a lot of time and attention and energy into training on the sales side that I have never seen before promoted within technical, and a lot of the management I've had in the past in IT, they just happened to be the guy that was still there, that was still left, or whatever, was maybe the slightly older guy, and they get promoted with zero additional training. Like I became a manager of people with no training, and that pretty much through my career I've seen that being the case, and I've talked to other people and that seems to be the case, and I have no idea why we think these people that are very technical individuals are all of a sudden magically going to be good with dealing with people and human aspects. Whereas sales folks, right? It seems like most of what you do is relationship building, right? You're working on soft skills. You're dealing with people. And so it seems like you're going to be more attuned to that. And maybe having said that, I've seen some people in sales that aren't very good at managing folks.
Well, and I will tell you that salespeople in general are very selfish in nature.
Yeah.
They have to be, right? I mean, sales is one of the few occupations that you can write your own legacy and give yourself a raise every single year, right? The harder you work and the you know, the more productive you are, the more money you're going to make. And so I think a lot of salespeople are driven by one of two things, and this is what I found in my career. Either one is recognition and adulation, right? So, and the second is money. And it doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other, but they definitely gravitate towards more towards one or the other. And so when you look at a salesperson to become a manager, neither one of those things work. Because as a manager, if you are driven by recognition, you're in the wrong job, right? And so you've got to be able to be the one giving out the recognition, right, not necessarily taking it, right? So when the team does poorly, yeah, it's on your shoulders. But when the team does well, it's all them, right? So, I mean, that's really how that works. When you go into management, if you're money-driven, that's a tough place to be, because you're just going to be chasing deals as opposed to leading the team and trying to create something that's sustainable for the future, right? So somebody once told me that the best managers in the world leave the team better than how they found it. And so it's easier for that next person who steps into that role.
Right.
But no, you're right. I mean, and I also think it's a product of the company itself, right? I think, you know, how big is Red Hat employee-wise?
I'm not sure if I can actually say.
10,000 plus? Is it that big?
I'm not. Well, there's some stuff we're not supposed to talk about, and I think headcount is one of them.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, they're not small, and there's a reason that company got as big as it did, right? And it's not because, while they might have really great product, if you don't have people, it's not going to go anywhere. So, you know, there are very few companies that get to the size of an Amazon or some of these other really large companies, and it's really because probably because of the leadership teams that are inside of it, and getting, you know, strategically, how do you place different people, and do you have an eye for talent? I mean, there's just so many things that go into that.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, and how a company chooses to spend its time and the attention that it focuses on things. You know, it seems like coming from the IT side, right? And you know, because I've been on both sides of it, you know, and at Fibertown, I felt like I sort of straddled the line, right? I wasn't just purely IT. I was, you know, I would kind of chameleon my way around wherever I needed to fit in. And now I guess I'm more on the sales side. But, you know, there still is kind of a, I don't know, I'm going down rabbit holes that were within my head that you can't actually see. But yeah, it's there's always been this sort of mentality, at least in IT, where you have salespeople and then you have sales engineers. And in a lot of people's mind, there's always this clear delineation that if it's a salesperson, they're just trying to sell me something. And that if it's a sales engineer, hey, they're just another guy like me, you know, pushing bytes around, configuring stuff. So it seems so strange how they know that I'm from sales. They understand that to be true. And yet they still treat me differently, right? Like I get this different approach. Did you feel that ever, like in your technical roles?
Yes, of course. So we had analysts that we could take with us in previous positions that would be much more technical in nature. I mean, when I mentioned earlier about, you know, matching Pantones and the software, and it's obviously hooking on their network, which was sort of new. I mean, if you look back in 2002, 2003, right, you're hanging something weird on their network, and we would bring these analysts, and they would listen to those guys way before they'd listen to me. And I think the perception is, who's getting paid? If I'm on the other side of the table and I'm a customer, I'm like, okay, what does this person stand to gain? And I think that's, you know, it's the WIFM, right? What's in it for them? And I think that's what it kind of boils down to. So as a customer, you go, okay, so this analyst, what's in it for them? Well, they're just the knowledge expert, right? So they're the subject matter expert. They're not getting a commission check on this thing, but this sales guy, and it goes back to years and years of it being ingrained in our head that they're slimy and things like that, they stand to gain a whole lot more. So should I believe somebody that stands to gain a whole lot from making me or getting me to do something, right? I mean, that's always sort of that trust factor.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, and once I started, and again, my opinion didn't change until I started really working closely with the sales team and doing stuff like that, where I realized this person selling you something, they're a resource, just like any other resource, right? And I can choose to use them or I can't. So why not use them Like you said, steal the wheel, right? If there's some piece of information, there's some knowledge, there's some way that they can help me, why not utilize them to their full potential? And it's so funny how we always come in with our own biases, you know, and instead of like sort of my mantra is never assume malice, right? Always assume good intent when you're going into any situation. Cool. Right?
Good for you.
Well, another way I've heard it described is never assume malice when ignorance is a more plausible answer, right? They're just an idiot. You know, they didn't actually mean to do that. They're just dumb or uninformed, right? To me, it's like if you've never been introduced to information, you've never had the opportunity to discover that, is it really your fault you don't know it? And to that, I usually try and say no. So it helps keep me sane.
And the unfortunate part is with the stigma that salespeople get, you know, I've worked in organizations where there's 120 salespeople in one office. And if you really were honest about it and you took a poll or you figured out very quickly who falls on the side of in it for them and the other side of who's in it for the customer, it's really much heavier weighted who's in it for the customer. I think most salespeople in general, just want to do what's right, because I think they understand that if a win is not a win if it's only making me happy, right? It's got to be a win on both sides of the table. Yeah. Because long-term viability within a customer base, depending on what your product is and depending on how much longer you've got to interface with that customer. You know, I mean, if I'm selling pencils and that's all I have and it's one and done, okay, maybe that's a little bit different. But most businesses don't operate like that. Most businesses, you're trying to create that relationship. You're trying to be that resource, like you said, that the customer thinks about and comes to you. So it's tough because I still think, hell, we had customers at Fibertown that I know for a fact did not like salespeople.
Oh, yeah.
Right? For whatever reason. And so it's unfortunate. You know, no one's from a sale sitting on that side of the table for so long. None of these guys are no salesperson is calling you just to bug you. Believe me, that's the last thing we want to do. We really do believe that we've got you've got a problem potentially and I've got a fix for it, right? And I think if people went about it a little bit differently, if you were just transparent about it and not trying to get, you know, so sneaky about some things that salespeople might do to get their foot in the door, but conversely, they have to do it because the door is shut all the time. So, you know, for me, it's always been transparency and honesty. I mean, lose fast, win fast, you know, however you're going to do it. Understand very quickly if there's a fit. And if there isn't a fit, move on. There's a ton of customers out there.
Yeah. And I think you were the first person I ever heard say, lose fast, win fast. And that really stuck with me because it's like you've only got so much time during the day, right? You can always get more people. You can always get more money. One thing you can't get is time. So you got to use it as wisely as possible, right? So why would I waste my time?
Well, and the really successful salespeople view their time just as valuable, if not more valuable than the customer's time. And so really successful, and I think people in general view their time that way. So why sit there and try to waste it on something, on someone that's never going to budge or it's just not going to work. It's not a good fit. And we're not a good fit. And I say we, whatever company mm-hmm. you work for, you're not a good fit for every customer. If you were, everyone would be wanting to work for you. I mean, if your product was universal like that and there was no competition and there was no alternative, we would all want to go work for that company.
Yeah. That's something else. I've learned so many various things from you. One of them was I remember being in a meeting with you, and within the first 5 or 10 minutes, you said I can't remember 100% what you asked them, but it was like, so you don't need this, you don't need that. It's like, I don't think we're a good fit for you. It's like, you basically just flipped the script and said, convince me why I should sell to you. And like, I don't know that we closed that deal or not one way or the other, but that was like very eye-opening for me. It's like, hey, I honestly, from everything you're telling me, I don't see where we fit in. And, you know, I want to give you your day back. You know, I want, you know, you to use your time as expeditiously as possible. And I guess it's just realization that you realize this is probably not going to close. It's that win fast, lose fast mentality, right? So
how many times have you been in a meeting for like an hour and a half and you walk out and you go, that was pointless. They're never going to do anything. that was the stupidest hour and a half of my life that I can't get back.
Yeah.
So let's just skip all that and let's spend 15 minutes and then go, all right, well, 15 minutes a day is not that big of a deal. An hour and a half is a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, so something else that happened when we were at Fibertown is you got introduced to the Sandler sales system, right? And it seemed like going into it, you may have been a little apprehensive, but once you got into it, it seemed like there was definitely a shift in your perception of the training, and it seemed like you were really on board with it. And you even were nice enough to share the CD with me that they had given you. And I've subsequently lost the copy I made, so I need to find that again. But I remember I learned so much from that. But it was interesting to see you start introducing some of those sales techniques that they taught you in training. And for somebody who had been selling, I mean, you'd been selling for up to this point, what, like 15 years?
Yeah.
Something like that. So how weird was that for you to, one, you know, re-examine the way you do something? Like, it was fundamentally part of you, right? Like if somebody asks you, what do you do for a living? You're like, I'm a sales guy. And so this is like this thing that you know, and you know so intimately, and then all of a sudden you realize that maybe you can actually improve and start. But you don't seem like the kind of close-off guy that would say that you couldn't improve anymore.
Well, for me, it was refreshing. You know, most sales training is very theory-based. So when I say that, it's, okay, you say this, and then the customer says this back. And then you say that, and then the customer, well, that's not how that works.
Yeah,
like,
never.
Every customer is going to say something different. And so that's why sales training in general drives me insane. Because I'll give you a quick anecdote, and then I'll go back to your question. I was a director of sales at the company that I alluded to before, and I was part of our job was I had to go to Orange County for a week and observe new hire training because they wanted us to know what they were doing from a training perspective. And so for 5 days I was there, or you know, a whole week. So on Thursday of that week, I couldn't take it anymore, and I had to tell them, you guys are doing this all. I'm like, you can't do it like this anymore. I'm like, this is not how this goes. It was, you say this and the customer says this, and then you say that. And I'm like, in a perfect world, that is exactly how that goes. But no one lives in a perfect world. So that sales training in general drives me nuts. Now, what was different with Sandler was it's all about having a productive conversation. And if you boil down what sales is, that's what that is. So it's for both parties to feel like that conversation was beneficial and productive. And so there were different techniques that you could do. You know, one of the other things that I thought was really great was something that I've never done in my career up until now and up until going through that training was they did, as a salesperson, you lay out the process of what you're going to do to the prospect. And you say, look, here's how this works. If everything works okay in scenario A, we move to scenario B. And this is what scenario B looks like in after scenario B. So I think it takes a lot of that anxiety away from prospects, right? If I walked into a car dealership and the guy goes, you're going to take a test drive and then I'm going to close you, at least I know what's coming, right? So I can prepare myself for that. And they give part of that Sandler, part of the biggest part of it is you give the customer an out at every turn. Hey, if this doesn't look good, I want you to be able to tell me that it doesn't look good. And if there's any reason we should walk away from this, I'm okay with that. Like, it's okay. I'm a big boy. I'll put on my pants tomorrow and I'll go out and find somebody else. So that was the biggest aha for me. And I think that's why it was refreshing. It was so much different than what I had ever gone through before. And I had gone through some pretty good sales training up until that point. This was just different. This was translatable. You could apply it to your relationship with your significant other. You could apply it to your relationship with your children, with your parents. I mean, there were lots of things that you could pick and choose from to apply to everyday life, not just necessarily sales.
Oh, yeah.
So that was the biggest thing for me.
I remember from the audio stuff that I was listening to, there were a handful of things that really stuck with me. One was the pattern interrupt, right? It's like, this is the normal exchange. I say this, you say that, I said, and then when they do something that completely turns it on its head and breaks you out of that, like that was significant to me. That, like, that surprised me in a way that I hadn't anticipated. And the idea of, it's called the upfront contract, right? where you agree that this is what's going to happen. And you also say at the end, I'm going to ask you for something. And is that okay? And so you get their acknowledgement, right? So the idea of, and I ghosted many a salesperson prior to doing the Sandler training, right? You know, it's like, I just needed a quote on something, blah, blah, blah. And so then they wouldn't set any upfront contract. Like, at the end of this is what you're going to do for me. And so they would give me my numbers. I would work internally, and then it wouldn't work out. And so then they would just keep chasing me and chasing me and chasing me. But had they had said, at the end of this, I need you to be honest with me. Because one of the things, like you said, is I remember in that training, they said, this isn't going to hurt my feelings. Don't worry about hurting my feelings. I'm okay. I just need you to be honest. If you feel this way, just say that you feel this way. It's like, it's perfectly okay, you know? And I remember that being like a crazy concept. And so after that, one, I quit ghosting salespeople. I would just be very upfront and honest with them about it. But I thought it was, I don't know. I just thought that was so brilliant. There was something, I mean, there's many something others. What did they call it? Like, 3 or 5 seconds of guts, something like that. Whenever you're talking to somebody, at some point in that conversation, there's going to be one gotcha that you're afraid that if you tell them this, they're not going to want to sign. And that's the moment where you have just like 5 seconds of guts and you ask them the question, hey, this car doesn't come in red. We don't have it available right now. Is that going to be a problem? Is this a deal? So, you know, and so it's like, you get it out of the way. You rip the bandaid off. And like, that was transformative for me too, because, there's some part of my personality where, probably not so deep down, I'm a people pleaser, and I just don't like, and I want everybody to like me, and you know, all that stuff. And so part of it is I'm afraid if I say these things, right, everything's going to go wrong. And so that, I don't know, it somehow gave me the courage to just get that out of the way, you know?
You know, crazy people would rather not do that, not have the 3 seconds of guts, and chase a prospect for months, and you know, the prospect doesn't call them back because they go, look, we're not going to do this because the car didn't come in red, right? I would have much rather known that up front, so we walk away. Okay, good, sorry, that I can't help that portion of this deal or this transaction, and that's okay, like it's fine, I'll go find somebody else. So and that pattern interrupt is interesting. You know, one of the things that they talked about, nobody likes cold calling. I don't care, I interview sales reps all the time, and what's your favorite part of the job? I love to cold call. I can't stand when people do it because no one likes to do it.
Yeah.
And that part of that was, you know, typically when you make a phone call, you know, somebody answers on the other line and you say, hi, this is Tony. I'm with, you know, ABC company. Do you have a second? Right. And so right away the guy goes, I get them, right. I get those calls. Yeah. I'm like, dang it. Why did I pick up the phone? You know, part of that pattern interrupt was to call and say, hey, Jim, I hate making these calls. I can't stand it, but it's part of my job, and here's what I have to do, and can we talk for maybe 15 seconds, and if it sounds like something you want to talk more about, then we can do that. Most people go, oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, okay, right? So it's all about sort of changing perception and that little don't act like everybody else type.
Yeah. One of the pattern interrupt piece I remember I picked up from there was, I think they even gave this example. They said, you get on the phone and you're like, hey, you know, is this John? You know, you don't say who you're from or whatever. And they say, yeah, you know, who wants to know, blah, 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 whatever. And you say, look, my name's Greg. I represent blah, blah, blah. Look, I'm a sales guy and I'm just going to be completely honest with you. You don't know me, but can you give me 30 seconds? I'll give you my pitch. And if it doesn't work, if this is not a match, then I'll race you to hang up the phone. If it does, we'll get, you know, we'll exchange information and we'll pick a time to talk. And it's, I've actually had to use that. I've used that a lot of times and never once has anybody said no and then just hung up on me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it legitimately works. You know what when I kind of walk this stuff back and I think a little deeper about it, I think about like the 3 seconds of guts and the pattern interrupt, I think what you're doing is you're showing some vulnerability. You're saying, hey, I'm afraid of this thing. You know, I'm just like you. I'm worried. I have, you know, stuff that concerns me. And I think that humanizes you in that moment. And they stop seeing you as a salesperson, right? And they just see you just as like another human being, right? So even for that little conversation.
Yeah, most people innately are good, whether we want to believe that or not. Yeah. I really believe that most people want to help other people. So that's a great point. I mean, I think if you show some vulnerability, you know, I had a rep at Fibertown, and she, you could probably guess who this was, but I won't name it. if she was getting ghosted, she would send an email and say, did I do something wrong? I've called you and you're not answering. Did I mess up somewhere? And 9 times out of 10, the person would reply just right back and say, no, you didn't mess up, right? Trying to save that person. No, you didn't mess up. We've just been super busy, or whatever the excuse would be at that point. Right. But she would probably 90% of the time get a response. So I think that goes back to, you know, opening up a little bit and showing that, you know, that vulnerable side of you, and people will try to save you, no doubt.
People will try and save you. Man, I've never thought about it like that. Because people do. They always want to be the hero of their story, right?
Yeah, they want to save you.
Huh. That's a fascinating insight. I've never even thought about that. So you alluded to it earlier, but I think you just kind of glossed over it. The fact that you are a huge sports fan. You were probably the closest thing to a fanatic as far as sports goes that I have met. Obviously, running in IT circles, I don't run into a lot of like super sportsy sports ball guys. And I've always just been kind of curious. It's like, what's your relationship with sports, and why are you so nutty about it? Like, where does that even come from?
You know, my dad's not a huge sports fan.
Okay.
I can remember watching. Now, there are certain sports, obviously, I like better than others. But I can remember watching college football when I was like 9 years old by myself, and there was just something about it. It was the pageantry, and it was and later I figured out really what I like about the college game more than the pro is that they get to choose to go there, right? They're not, you know, these pros are drafted. They have to go, the really great guys go to the crappiest teams every year because they're at the draft board, right? So, but I think it's the competition. I think it's the only thing real on TV anymore. Everything else is so staged. I mean, reality shows are probably more staged than a sitcom was that, you know, we grew up watching. So it's the only thing that the conclusion or the finale is in doubt until the very end. Anything can happen. But man, I've just always been this shutdown and COVID has killed my sports fix.
I know. I was wondering how you've been coping.
So they play a lot of old classic games on a lot of the channels. So I've watched a couple of those. Baseball has started back up. It's really eerie to watch baseball. I don't know if you've watched, you know, in the last couple of days they've been playing games and there's no one in the stands, which is really creepy. You know, you're used to at least, even in the worst teams, people behind home plate would be sitting there in the expensive seats, and there's no one there, and it's really creepy. I think for me, I don't get it from like a sport. The love of sports, I think, is about the competition. I'm impressed by anyone that can get to that level inside of anything. So, you know, be the best at what you're doing. And these guys that are professional athletes on the field are at the top of their game, you know, globally, really. I mean, it's pretty impressive that what these guys can put their bodies through and how they get themselves ready for every season.
Yeah. I mean, and I get what you mean. Like somebody who's at the top of their game, if you'll forgive the pun, you know, like whatever it happens to be, you know, like, so I'm an avid YouTuber. Avid YouTuber. So I watch a lot of weird stuff that people wouldn't necessarily expect me to. So there's stuff like I like making. So there's people like the Corning Museum of Glass. Like, so they actually put on people that are masters at blowing glass. And so I just love watching these guys do it. It's mesmerizing watching these guys create like these most stunning pieces of art out of basically molten sand. You know what I mean? And so like people that have been doing it for 40 years and they're just so deft in their movements and they're so good. So I think I can watch an expert at whatever they do. You know, the people at the top of their craft, it's just, it's fascinating to watch somebody who's honed their skill so much, right? So I totally get that.
And especially if you've tried to do, so if you've tried to do the things that these guys can do, it's pretty impressive, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've never tried to blow glass, and I have no doubt that the people are really, really good at it, yeah. But I think I would appreciate it more, right, if I tried it and it ended up it's just like watching the I Am Not Handy around the house at all. And some of the stuff that these guys do on HGTV, right? And I'm not a big watcher. My wife will watch it, and I'll watch them a couple times. But that's always impressive to me too, right? That people can just knock down walls and know how to rebuild it. Like, I just, my brain doesn't work that way.
Yeah. It runs the gamut. So there's people that make stuff. So there's like Jimmy Doresta. I love watching him make stuff. There's this guy, Baumgartner Restorations. He restores artwork of all various kinds. And so you watch these videos of him like intricately filling in these gaps and like I don't know what it is about my brain, but I love watching that stuff. So you're talking about competition, and that is like really interesting to you. When's the last time you like competed at something? And I mean, I guess sales technically is competing, right? A lot of people view it as a competition.
Well, that would probably be, yes. I mean, every day of my career for the last 20 years has been a competition of some sort. I mean, because you're either competing against another company, right? So you have competitors,
right?
Market. You're competing internally, whether you're trying to be the best at inside of that company, right? So there's all kinds of competition when it comes to work. From a competing, it's a good question. You know, maybe I'm not that competitive outside of work. I don't participate in any any organized sports of that nature. That's a good question. I don't know. I consider myself a competitive person.
When was the last time you actually had the opportunity to compete at something? You know what I mean? Because you've been in management, so once you get to management level, right, I think you alluded to it earlier, the golden rule is not to compete with your employees, because I mean that's a recipe for disaster.
You could compete with your boss a little bit. I don't know. You know, I coached my kid's soccer team. That probably should not really come up as being competitive. But it sucks to lose, right? I don't like losing. That's the problem. I don't know. That's a good question. When's the last time I've competed? You know, I've gotten into I go to the gym a lot now, and I've gotten that. So competing really against myself, right, and trying to add weight or trying to run a faster mile or whatever that is, I do, and I track and I keep, you know, tabs on that. But I'm 40. I'll be 42 this year. I don't know about competing against anybody else in a physical activity. I'd probably get smoked. So, and I don't like losing. So maybe.
You know, earlier you were talking about how salespeople are generally motivated by either money or adulation. So, whenever you moved to management, did you change what your measuring stick is for yourself, or do you still kind of see it as those two things still?
Well, the measuring stick for me in management is how well the team does. I mean, that really is it, and no man left behind, right? I mean, I think that you see a lot of managers, if you've been in business for a while, you see a lot of managers who have a team of, you know, 6 to 8 people, and traditionally 3 are really good and 3 just kind of plod along, and then you have 1 or 2 that they could take or leave, right? My whole thing was, I don't ever want to do that. I had a manager one time tell me, we need those plotters. We need the people that are 60 to 80% of plan. And I didn't agree with it at all. I don't agree with that theory. If you can find somebody to be 100% as opposed to 80, why wouldn't you make the change? So for me, it was always continually getting better. And whether that was developing somebody to get them better, but some people don't have the capacity to do it. Some people just aren't cut from that cloth, and they want to be a plotter, right? I mean, I used to do this thing where I'd say, hey, all these new hires would come in, and I'd ask them, raise your hand if you want to make $100,000 this year. And so inevitably, all the hands go up. And so I go, okay, let me walk you guys through how that happens. And I'd go up to the board and I would break it down per average sale, and then how many sales you're going to have to make, average commission on that. And I'd get it all the way down to how many phone calls you have to make, just knowing the ratios. And then I'd ask the question again, how many of you guys want to do it? And inevitably, there'd be 3 or 4 that would keep their hands up, and 3 or 4 would go, hey, what does it take to make like 75 grand? So for me, it was those people that I would have to look at a little bit differently, knowing that they just don't want to put in the work. And so when you talk about competition and how do you view success, for me it was always, how does the team do? But you can't always look at that, because you could have one really stellar performer on a team and it carries the team. So you've got to really look at it as a holistic approach, and I didn't want to leave anybody behind. Now, that didn't mean that I wouldn't kick them off the boat, right? That could have been part of the plan, but I wanted to find the team that would perform day in and day out. And what you do is you foster that competition on the team. You know, if you've got one really good player and the rest of them are not very good, it could go real sideways on you real quick. They could resent that person very quickly, right? Because they're not successful, and right. So they want to point fingers as opposed to looking introspectively and say, okay, what do I have to do to be like that guy? So trying to get everybody on the same page, and it fosters really healthy competition amongst one another.
Gotcha. How do you take the temperature of the group to make sure, you know, you're not getting like one bad apple in there that's just kind of ruining everything for everybody else?
You know, I've had that experience. So I think if you are, if your employees trust you, and I think that's paramount in any sort of leadership role, you have to be consistent. Consistency is very important because everybody knows what they're going to get all the time. You can't be this erratic person.
Oh yeah.
And you have to be, I pride myself on being as transparent as I possibly can be. Obviously, there's situations in management that you're not going to tell your employees everything. However, building that trust is paramount, because if you don't have trust, when you ask them to run through a wall, they're not going to trust you, right? So if you have that kind of trust, somebody will in that group will come tell you. Absolutely. And it happened to me. It's happened to me multiple times in my career where I've let somebody go. The first time it happened was they didn't tell me, and I let the guy go, and I had three reps within 10 minutes of that guy getting let go, walk in my office and say thank you. Like, well, why didn't you guys tell me that before, right? I mean, so that was a learning experience for me. And so it's happened. I mean, if you have somebody complaining about somebody else on a team, you've got real issues, right? And it could be, and I'm not saying it may not be the complainer either, right? And maybe that person too, I don't know. But I think trust is huge, and people have to trust you, and you have to, but trust is earned, and you've got to be able to trust them as well. You know, I've seen too many times in my sales career where the manager doesn't trust reps. We had it. I mean, if you look at my first boss when I started at Fibertown, right, he was completely against working remotely. And I used to tell him, look, if you don't think these people are working, you've got the wrong people in place. Right. It's not necessarily the process is bad. You don't trust these people. Why? So I think it works both ways on that.
Yeah, for sure, man. You know, and I was thinking about it because I try and just look at the human aspect and stuff. So it's like, do you think some of those people that didn't put up their hand, do you think it was they were plotters, or maybe they were just afraid that they couldn't do it? Maybe they wanted to, but... And so it's like, if you have somebody that you know, see that potential in, you know, they could do it. Did you have to cheerlead a lot? You have to do the rah, rah, rah speech?
Yeah. Well, I think everybody kind of reacts differently to different motivating, you know, tools.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not a big rah, rah guy, as you probably know. And I can do it if I think it'll work. So it just depends on what everybody else is going to react to. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, those people that are afraid or may, sometimes it's just, they don't know, right? They don't know that they're capable of more.
Right.
And I think your greatest leaders in the world, business, politically, however you want to look at it, get more out of people than they ever thought they would get out of themselves. Right. So you look at sports, right? So we talked about sports, some of the greatest coaches in the world, you know, ever in whatever sport you want to look at, we're getting more out of their people than they thought they could get out of themselves, right? So I think that's pretty key.
You'll survive it. So you're talking about how coaches can get more out of people than they, you know, what's funny is you're saying that, you know, some of those coaches, those most successful coaches, you know, can really motivate a team. And I think there's still sports teams today that can say that about their coaches. But you know what And just, you know, I don't put a lot of time and energy into it, but I've brushed across a few stories where those most successful coaches have some of the least fulfilling personal lives. Because it's like, that is their entire life. You know, that is all that they are, you know, and they're spending, you know, 20 hours a day on this team. And then whatever's left happens to go towards maybe their family.
And, but I think we've all had, or maybe, I know I've had bosses like that, that they eat, sleep, and breathe business. And they're uber successful, right? And so it's a work-life hey, that works for some people and other people it doesn't work for.
Yeah.
But I think that comes in all walks of life, whether that's coaching or just business, right?
Yeah. I used to compare myself to people a lot. And, you know, I later in life, I'm sure you've heard the adage, comparison is the thief of joy. I think everybody's heard that at some point or another. And I've learned that most of the successful, like, guys, most successful technical guys, like, I know guys that will literally sit down and read an RFC for 7-8 hours so that they fully understand something before they even begin to research to implement these things. And, you know, they're like, you can talk to them about anything and they are so knowledgeable, very opinionated because they put a lot of time and energy into it. But then as I started peeling back the layers on those onions, I realized that their brains don't allow them to not do that, right? There's no part of them that says, it's okay for me not to know this. Like, they are so fearful and anxiety ridden that if they don't do this, the voices in their head will make them, you know, go back to killing vagrants on the weekend. You know what I mean? It's like, so it's like, I stopped comparing myself to those people because, one, I'll never be that person. And two, I never want to be that person. Like, you know, I don't want to have that be part of my personality. You know what I mean? It's like, I like my family, you know, and I like having the opportunity to turn off and to not stress about it and to talk to other people. Well,
think about it. Today, we are more connected than we have ever been.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have my cell phone on me 24 hours a day. I mean, it gets plugged in on my nightstand. So at night, literally, it's next to my bed.
Didn't you used to have, like, paranoia of your battery, like, being dead, so you would always have it plugged in?
It's at 94% right now. So, yes, I get freaked out when it gets to like 80 in the 80s. Anyways, but we work more than we've ever worked before.
Yeah.
We just work differently, right? I mean, you know, think about before the BlackBerry came about, we would get email at work. And then maybe you might have a laptop that you would take home, but was it really expected that you plugged in? Maybe, maybe not, depending on your position and what you were doing. But today, somebody can get a hold of me 24/7, whether it's via text, whether it's via an email, right? My phone will go off either way. So, you know, talking about work-life balance, I still believe that people are working just as hard today. It's just in a different fashion. It's just different.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, it's been different for everybody. So I know for me, like going into COVID, like maybe a week or two. So I think we went into quarantine, like really, we were supposed to like quarantine in March, somewhere around in there. And then I think 2 days later, I had my first interview with Red Hat, like on the phone, like that one, right? You know, or maybe that was my panel interview, my big one. So which that would have been my last one. And then
like, you left really early in March or like early into the lockdown.
Yeah. Super early. So I pulled the ejection lever really fast into to lockdown and left Fibertown and kind of jumped ship over to Red Hat. And so many things were moving at once, you know, so it's like for me, like being an engineer, the way I always try and troubleshoot or do things like that is I change one variable at a time, test and see how it goes, right? And then change another variable, right? So you give it time. For me, I kind of changed every variable all at once. So I changed jobs. We went into quarantine. You know, it's like everything changed. And so there were some times where I was having some real trouble adjusting with life. I mean, I'd already worked from home in essence forever, you know, so I was accustomed to that. I think, you know, there was a couple of times where I just felt like I was going to scream. Like I felt like I was trapped and stuff like that. It was just, I don't know, man, just everything changing at once, putting a lot of pressure on myself, you know, like this new job, which is amazing because these guys have put the least amount of pressure of any organization on me. And it's like, I'm putting it all on myself. You know, I guess when you're surrounded by some really talented guys, it's like you want to make sure, you know, you're keeping up with the Joneses and stuff like that. So, I don't know. It's been really weird. I'm pretty leveled out now. You know, I've got a new routine. All that stuff's going. What's it been like? What was that transition like for you, man?
You know, meeting people in sales in my profession and getting in front of customers is really the lifeblood of what we do. And so for me, that was the most difficult adjustment, was how do you get in front of somebody that when you're locked down? Are you there?
Yeah.
You've frozen on the screen. So anyway, so for me, that was the hardest adjustment. And then obviously with the kids at home, trying to do homeschooling was obviously a challenge as well. But, you know, this is like the new norm. I mean, this is what we're doing now, and this is how it's going to be. I mean, I think, you know, if you go back to 9/11, there were things that got put into place that never went away. So, you know, no longer can you, you know, walk somebody all the way down to the terminal at the airport.
Right.
Things like that that you don't really think about. Those types of things that we're seeing change will be the new norm. I mean, I don't know that grocery stores will ever go back to not being 6 feet apart and not having that little plastic, you know, barricade up at the cashier desk. So it's different for everybody. And I think the hardest part about this whole thing is how unknown everything is. Like, what is the end? I mean, I keep going back to, okay, so let's say we flatten this curve, or, you know, whatever that looks like, and we flatten that in the next month and a half. And so in 45 days, we open up everything back again. Well, as we all go back out to the wild, is it just going to go spike back up again? Like, I don't understand what the end of this thing is, unless ridiculous in my estimation, but I don't know. So the adjustment for me was, it's still going. It's ongoing. I think every day I'm going nuts. Like, my kids are here all the time, which I love to death, right? But it will drive you crazy after a while. I'm excited for them to go back to school, and now that's not happening. So they pulled that rug out from underneath us last week.
Oh, so you guys are going to be homeschooling your kids next year?
Well, at least through September 8th. So they were supposed to go back August 12th. I mean, this is probably not the conversation for this, but I don't know why they don't just push the start date back to September 15th and then have them go a little bit further into June. I mean, hell, these kids have been off for 6 months as it is, for the most part.
Yeah, I think our school district down here, what they're doing is they're offering you have the option to do one or the other. You can either send your kids to school or you can homeschool. I think it would behoove everybody who is capable of homeschooling to do it, right? Because, I mean, it's just going to be a bunch of kids jammed into one room. They're all going to stay in the same room with one teacher, which at that point is really just going to be more or less a babysitter. For the exact same curriculum that the kids are going to be doing from the home. So you might as well just do it from the house. And you know what's tripping me out is to think about my oldest kid is going into ninth grade. This would have been his first year in high school. Like, he would have been a freshman in high school, and now he's just going to be at home. It's like, isn't that... I know pretty much universally everybody dislikes high school. Like when they look back, they're like, yeah, it wasn't my favorite time of life, but I think it is very formative time in your life, right? You learn to deal with other people because everybody else is going through puberty and they're all acting like assholes. And, you know, it's just like all just learning to navigate all those social situations, I think, is so important. And I hate the idea that my kid's going to lose that.
Well, and look at, I have a nephew who is a sophomore at Baylor, and, he got pulled out of school, you know, last year, halfway through the year, and they all went virtual. Like, my college experience was I had a ton of fun in college and met a lot of people and learned a lot about myself and what I like and what I don't like. And you missed out on that too. I mean, kids belong in school. I think not only just for the learning aspect, cause they're not going to learn anything in my house. I can tell you right now, I don't just teach math. And by the way, when did math become any different than 3 + 3 = 6? My kids are bringing home dots and lines and all kinds of crazy
stuff.
That's
broke my brain.
And so I think, you know, not, it's more for the social aspect of it. Yeah. I mean, my kids are going to, so I have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old, both girls, and they're at each other's throats right now. And I looked at my wife today And I said, what is wrong with them? She goes, they've been cooped up in this house for 4 months with no one else to talk to but themselves. Right. So, all right. Well, then I felt bad about, you know, getting angry about it. But, you know, that's the reality. That's where we're at.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I don't, you know, it's what I, you know, believe it or not, my wife and I started journals kind of partly because of this stuff. It's like, you know, it's just, it's so strange to think about the times we're in. And I want to see where we came from and where we ended up. You know, and I was thinking that this is going to be one of those watershed moments in our children's lives, you know, so like 30, 40 years from now, their kids are going to, or their, maybe their grandkids are even, you know, they're going to hear stories about what it was like in the quarantine. Now, granted, you know, they'll be like, yeah, we heard there was rioting and, you know, there was like, you know, all these people doing crazy. And you know, they'll just say, yeah, we just kind of played video games at the house and swam in the pool, you know, so it's, they're not going to have, you know, like any cool stories to tell. But I was just thinking how, you know, it's, you know, I think, what did you call it? Flashbulb memories. Some people have, so like if you ask people of a certain generation, you know, it's like, where were you when JFK was assassinated? You found out about it, right? That, so for me, I remember, and you probably still remember, where you were when you heard about 9/11 for the first time. I remember I was driving in my little red Nissan. I was about 3/4 of a mile from my turn going to college. And I heard the DJs on the radio saying, wow, a plane just hit one of the trade centers. We don't know what, yeah. So it's like, it is like seared into my brain.
First one for me was when the Challenger, right? The space shuttle that had the teacher was on it. Cause we were all, I was at school and we were all in the cafeteria with you know, the roll up little TV.
Yeah.
We would put up there and we watched it live, which was kind of insane looking back on that. Yeah. And I just remember teachers like turning the TV off very quickly and sort of like ushering everybody back into class. But I remember that pretty distinctly. But yes, 9/11 was obviously, that's the one we're all remember.
Yeah. Right? And, but it's just because, you know, it's like our kids, while they'll remember this, you know what I mean? This is like a slow burn, right? There's no instantaneous, like, this thing is here and now we get to deal with it in the aftermath. This is like, it is, you know, what do you call it? It's like when big ships at sea have accidents, you know, they're moving at 1 mile an hour, but there's so much inertia that they just keep crashing in slow motion forever, you know? And I feel like that's what this stuff is. It's a slow motion car crash that is just not stopping, you know? And so there's no, like, it doesn't, you know, it's like when 9/11 happened, it felt like, wow, this was devastating. And it took a while for my kid brain to figure all that out. I mean, I was in college, but still a kid brain, you know? But then we, you know, start moving past it. It feels like we're still in the middle of this, you know, like we can't move past it. So it's.
That's right. I think that the for 9/11, if you weren't in New York,
right,
did about a week. I think it was, oh, okay, it's on the news every day. Like, this is on the news every day for like 6 months at this point, and it'll continue to be on it for another six, I think.
And what's crazy to me too is how politicized all this has gotten, you know? Spuds McKenzie over there. Yeah. It feels like a human thing. It seems like this sort of stuff should be elevated above all of that, you know? And it just super is not. So whatever.
I'm ready for it to get back to, and it'll never be normal, I don't think. I think a lot of stuff, like I said, is going to stay in place. Who knows? We may be mandated to wear masks for the next 5 years.
Yeah, which honestly, I'm okay with that. I guess, you know, I thought I was super antisocial, but I think part of, like, so I used to play pickleball all the time, and since we hit quarantine, I haven't done any of that stuff. Most of the people I know have already gone back to it, but it's like, to me, that feels irresponsible. I'm not going to do that because all these people are like the favorite demographic of COVID, right? They're all like older retired people. And it's like, Jesus, I can't be part of this problem, you know, and like infect all these. I can't kill Bob and Sue, you know, I can't do all that stuff. So,
well, the big part of me just wants to get it. Just let me get it and get over it because, you know, the numbers are on my side. The proportion of people that are hospitalized or die is, you know, much smaller than the number of people that actually, you know, have 3 days of symptoms and get over it. And so I think in my age, I'd rather get it now Obviously, if I was 70, I probably wouldn't be talking like that.
Right. But that's what everybody feels like, right? I just want to be done with it. I just want to be over it. I want to be on the other side of it. But, you know, it's like, you know, it does seem like it would be simpler. But then again, that contributes to the problem, right? With like overloading hospitals and all that stuff. And honestly, as much as I've thought that same thing, it's like, that's selfish of me to think that. So I'm calling you selfish, Tony. No, it's like the idea being that, you know, if you're sick, it's not you that really is hurt the most by it. It's the people around you that love you that can't do anything about it, and all they can do is watch and hope for the best. And I think you know what I'm talking about when I say that stuff, because it just, right, for you, if you have it or you have any terminal illness or anything happens to you, you got really for the most part, outcomes, right? Either I get over it and everything's great, or I die and it's somebody else's problem now, right?
Right.
Whereas everybody else has to deal with, and you know, it's like when I don't know if I ever told you this, but my wife went to the hospital like 2 weeks after my youngest was born. 2.5 weeks later out of ICU, she almost didn't make it. The doctors gave her like 30% chance of survival. And I basically put a lid on that, and I can't look at it too close because I kind of fall apart. Like, it's so weird for me. Like, if I loosen the lid on that jar a little bit, like, I just, it's over for me. And so I just keep it locked away in there, undealt with.
The healthy way to do it.
It is absolutely healthy. But you know what? It also makes me feel stupid for feeling that way. It makes me feel, like, selfish. Like, she lived. So, you know, why should I, like, you know, have all these feelings? You know what I mean? It's like stupid.
And the fact that she got over
it. Yeah. So I should be fine. Like, I should be totally cool, but I'm not. So I just kind of locked that away because.
Well, I think if you look at it, you know, what could have been, right? And how would that have affected not only you, but your children and everybody else? I mean, I get that.
Yeah. So I don't know. Not that I believe in selflessness. I think there's no such thing as a selfless act. Everybody gets something out of everything they do. Not to say it's not beneficial. It could benefit both, right? Like, it could help you and make me feel good. Then who cares, right? It's a win-win in my book. Yeah, I don't know. Some of that stuff's, I don't know. I get it. It's wacky. I don't know where to go. The only question I think that I really have for you is, why do you drink so much water, and what is wrong with you that you drink so much water?
I'm so tired of drinking water. You know, I have so many. If I ran to the pantry right now, I could show you like the basket full of Mio drops that we keep in this house, because my wife and I both drink a lot of water, and you get tired of, what else are you going to drink? What do you drink? I mean,
I used to drink tea. Like, we're from Texas, yeah, bro.
Mio drops, and I got tea Mio drops. I can do that. Water, right? I mean, for the most part.
That's right. And you can't stand the smell of coffee, right?
Yeah, I don't drink coffee. No. We don't even have a coffee pot in this house.
Your wife?
My wife doesn't do it. She'll drink cold brew. So she buys this. This is new for her. She buys this cold brew stuff. I don't like the smell of it. My kids like coffee.
Oh, my kids love coffee.
They think Starbucks is the coolest place ever. I can't stand it. I don't know what to order. Like, I went through there, and you have to order, like, everything is like 9 words long that you order. A caramel macchiato, mocha, extra caramel, whatever it is. I don't know.
Heaven forbid you ask for the large or the small or whatever.
Yeah, what movie was that? A venti? Yeah.
I don't know. They'll say, yeah, venti, and I'll say, whatever the large is. I never go there. I love the way it smells, love the way it tastes, but dude, that caffeine, like, it somehow, like, breaks my brain, and I feel, like, more lethargic. I don't know why.
Well, lately I've been hitting a wall at, like, 3 o'clock during the day, and I have found these drinks, Bang. Have you seen these?
Yeah, those energy drinks.
Yeah, so I do have a crutch midday. By the way, what time is it? It's 2:30. See, I got 30 minutes before I can drink that.
Save it as a little treat for yourself.
It is. It's nice. I mean, you know, I probably drink 8 bottles of water a day. I don't drink anything else. Like, it just gets old. Water gets old. There's no flavor. There's nothing going on there. Yeah. So,
I don't know.
I just,
after my kidney stone, I started drinking a ton of water, and I, like, basically cut out everything else. I've slowly started integrating other little things, but I can't make myself go back to drinking tea, because that's basically all I was drinking all day long.
Well, that's what did it, right? Because it's like a diuretic.
Well, I was drinking only tea pretty much, and then I was exercising a lot, and I wasn't drinking. Dehydrated. Really. Yeah, like, I would go to cycle class, and the floor would be soaked, and I wouldn't, like, really drink much after that, because I didn't want to get up and pee in the night. So I was like, I really kind of like screwed myself on that.
I had to cut myself off at like 7:30, 8 o'clock every night from drinking because of that reason.
Yeah, I still don't.
You worry about when you get old.
Yeah, I drink as much as I can whenever I can. If I can convince myself to do it, because, you know, it's like, it's getting, now that I've sort of like kind of gone back to normal, it's hard for me to like convince myself to keep drinking, because I was good. I was drinking like a gallon or more of water a day. Just the sheer paranoia of having it happen again. You know how that's, we have such short memories as humans. You know how that goes. So I'm desperately trying to keep myself drinking.
Yeah, that, I've heard that is one of the most painful things that a human being can ever go through.
Yeah.
Our kid.
I don't know. I was doped up most of it.
Oh, well. Yeah, that helped.
It still hurt a lot. I remember going to the hospital, and I was like, I am in pretty excruciating pain. And they were like trying to take my vitals, and they're like, sir, if you don't sit still, we're not going to let you go back. I was like, oh, my God, okay. So I just...
Well, that wasn't that long ago either, was it?
It was... About maybe? February was a year. February was a year. Yes. Yeah. It wasn't really that long ago. But I remember when they took me back there, like, we can give you a Motrin. I was like, no.
Did I stub my toe?
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, they had to do a scan, and then, yeah, like, immediately gave me some good stuff. But that was fun. Anyway, Tony, we've been at it for about an hour and 20 minutes. So if you want to stick a fork in it, we can.
Up to you.
All right. Well, I've enjoyed talking to you, man. I haven't talked to you for a really long time. And you are a very interesting guy. A lot of the guys that listen to this stuff, yeah, again, they're technical folks. They've probably not done much with sales. If you were to give them, say, a handful of tips, like, because a lot of these guys are starting to move into kind of like commercial sales, like selling to like bigger businesses or stuff like that. If they were going to approach people, what are some basics you think you could lay on? I mean, we already talked about a few, right?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things is, don't, if you own a company or you are in charge of a certain product or something like that, I wouldn't approach people leading with the product, right? I would probably approach people asking questions and finding out exactly, you know, what your product, what that solution, what it solves, what problem it solves. I find out if that person has that problem before I start hawking a product. It goes back to the whole, you know, win fast, lose fast, right? I mean, I don't want to sit here and it makes us feel really good when we talk about our product because we're the subject matter expert and I can tell you every bit and bite and, you know, nook and cranny of whatever I'm selling. Don't be afraid to lose. I mean, you don't want to waste your time. We talked about it. Time is the one thing we can't get back in life. It's super valuable. The last thing you want to do is, you know, surround yourself with people or chase people that don't want to be chased, right? I mean, that's a bad way to go about business. And three, I would say just be confident. I mean, I think everybody's product, if you've been around for any amount of time, is viable in the right situations, and you can't get beat up. You know, you're going to hear a lot more no's than you hear yeses. And if you're hearing a lot more yeses than you are no's, then you're doing a lot of these things already. So, but I would say that, you know, you got to be confident. You can't let don't take it personal, I guess is what I'm trying to say. None of it's personal. I've seen a lot of good salespeople get down that rabbit hole and feel bad about themselves and feel like they're, you know, their worth is judged by the fact that by this customer or potential customer. Right. So, those would be like just three really easy things, and then have fun with it. I mean, all you're doing is talking to people. You're just trying to figure out if your product meshes with their issues, right?
Yeah. I remember in that Sandler training stuff, one of the things it said was, you know, going back to your point about, you know, don't get down on yourself. They were talking about how, you know, say today you're feeling really just crappy. You know, it's like you haven't made a sale in a long time. You're just, you know, you're not feeling good. You know, you're grinding it out. Well, tomorrow, this sale you weren't expecting to close, this really big win, this whale comes in and it closes, right? And then the point was you feel really great after that, right? It's like, yeah, I've done something. But did you actually do anything that day that closed that sale? No, you didn't do anything. You did all of that work weeks ago, right? You put in all of that work. So why should you you know, if that's what actually sold it, that stuff weeks ago, why not feel that way then as opposed to today when it actually closes? So the idea being you're always moving yourself towards your goals, right? So don't get down on yourself, because everything you do, right, every positive interaction you have, every you know, like you said earlier, which I thought was really key to how you think about things, and you kind of changed my perspective, you sort of work backwards from the problem. And I learned that from our customers. You would say, all right, when do you need to be in the data center by? All right, well, here's the things you have to get done. So if you're going to order circuits, we got to go back at least 90 days, right? And then if you're going to committee, you've got these people, you got to send the contract through, we've got to go back this amount of time. And so I always thought that was fascinating how you worked backward from the problem. And I think that all that kind of ties together too, is that, you know, you have to kind of, for one, for me, compartmentalizing things, little bites and pieces, helps get the job done, right? Because it's not just, oh my God, I've got this monumental task I got to complete. If you break it down into its constituent parts, which I used to see you do in those meetings, and I'm sure you did it with your sales team too. That was really helpful. But also the idea of just, you know, try and stay as even as you can. Don't get down in the dumps. Because yeah, I could see how a salesperson that is motivated by wins, if they don't get one for a minute, getting a little down.
Think about, I mean, and you take the analogy when you look at sports and you look at some of these, you know, you look at an NFL team who plays 16 games and they're playing their 14th game and they're 2-12 at that point. How the hell do you stay motivated? Like, that's ridiculous to me, because the only reason they do that, I think the only reason is to win. Right? I mean, I'm sure some of them are in it for a paycheck. Right. They don't get paid any less if they lose potentially. So, but yeah, I mean, if you let your worth get dictated by your job, you got bigger issues than that, right? I mean, you're still, we play so many different roles in life, whether you're a father or whether you're a mother or you know, a brother or a friend or a manager or a mentor or sales rep, right? One shouldn't affect all the others. So don't let your complete self-worth feel like it's being dictated by one of those roles. So if I'm not doing well in my job, doesn't mean I'm a bad person, right? It just means I need to probably look at it and maybe change course of action inside of it.
Yeah, fair enough, man. That's some heavy advice.
As I get.
That's good, bud. That's good. All right, dude, we're at an hour and a half. It's time to stick a fork in it. So, Tony, thank you so much. If by chance somebody wanted to get a hold of you via the internet, how would you have them do that? What's your favorite avenue for that stuff?
LinkedIn, yeah. Tony Owens is the name. So I'm on LinkedIn, Facebook. LinkedIn's probably your best bet.
Yeah, it's a pretty decent way of getting a hold of me as well sometimes. All right, so I'm going to say for me, it's Greg at GregSoul.com. You go to GregSoul.com, where I very occasionally blog, The Brothers Wisp, where this is going to be posted, as well as other stuff. And then Patreon.com/The Brothers Wisp. You join in there, you get access to our patron-only Slack, and slide into my DMs there is probably the easiest way of getting a hold of me. I'm actually fairly active on there. I'm not sure if you slacked much, but it's just, you know, another corporate chat program that's very convenient to use.
My wife uses it with her company.
There you go. Well, Tony Owens, thank you so much for carving out a bit of your Saturday. And everybody else, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
All right.